I'm faced with a bit of a dilemma in this introduction, in that although president of the forum, most of you in this room do not know me. I'm the one who's supposed to introduce you to our speaker tonight, who is known to everyone here. He's one of the most famous throughout the United States, indeed throughout the world, and is one of the leading journalists. He's been involved in television journalism for over 35 years. In 1947, he started out in the print media, the Chicago Sun-Times, in his native Chicago, but quickly moved to the NBC affiliate there, WMAQ-TV. Since then, he's done virtually everything in television journalism. From the Midwest, starting out as a Midwest correspondent, he's been reporting from over 50 countries worldwide. He's been chief bureau correspondent for Moscow, Berlin. He's covered the common market in Brussels. He's covered Algerian civil wars, revolutions in Cuba, wars in Vietnam, and across the globe. Domestically, he's been, in 1964, he was chief White House correspondent, has covered every major Democratic and Republican convention since 1952, whether as co-anchor or as a floor correspondent. And for the past 15 years, he's been involved intimately with NBC Nightly News. He was the anchorman for NBC Nightly News for 12 years, and in 1982, he became a special self-designed NBC News commentator. He gives his analysis of the day, of the key issues of our day, his insights, and his wisdom accumulated over 30 years. He is extremely knowledgeable about his profession, and he's come here tonight to talk about his profession and our profession, the differences and the similarities. I've been informed that he invites questions. The speech will be brief, and then we will follow the traditional forum format of questions and answers, alternating from the various microphones before me. I'd like you all to welcome now John Chancellor.
Thank you. Nice to be down. Thank you. I don't want to make a long speech tonight. I've written out some remarks on the title of which was Lawyers and Journalists, Differences and Similarities. I don't have a lot about lawyers in there, I'm afraid. Do your speakers often start with jokes? I have a joke that has absolutely nothing to do with my talk. Would you like to hear the joke? Joke. Three very prominent men die in an airplane crash. One is President Reagan. The other is the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Thomas P. O'Neill. The third is the Chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Paul Volcker. They die. They suddenly find themselves in front of St. Peter. And he says, "Welcome." And he consults his clipboard, and he says, "Mr. Reagan, that's room number one for you, please." And Ronald Reagan goes into room number one, and there's a mad dog in room number one. Terrible, vicious dog. And a loudspeaker in the ceiling says, "Ronald Reagan, you have sinned. Your penalty is to spend eternity in this room with a mad dog." Now, Thomas P. O'Neill and Paul Volcker hear this, and St. Peter says, "Speaker O'Neill, room number two, please." And O'Neill goes into room number two, and there is a huge gorilla, angry. And the speaker says, "Thomas P. O'Neill, you have sinned, and your penalty is to spend eternity with an angry gorilla." And Paul Volcker is left outside. And St. Peter says, "Mr. Volcker, room number three, please." Volcker, quite upset at this point, goes into room number three, and there is Bo Derek. And the speaker says, "Bo Derek, you have sinned." I've been waiting to tell that in public since I heard it. As I say, it has nothing to do with lawyers and journalists. "We are," he said, beginning to read his prepared copy, We are similarly concerned and sometimes obsessed by facts, journalists and lawyers. We like to marshal them in orderly rows. We care about the language, although perhaps in different ways. Imagine two old clergymen talking. One says, "Well, we both did the work of the Lord." And the other says, "Yes, you in your way, and I perhaps in his." That's how journalists sometimes feel about lawyers. Although God knows lawyers are the source of a great deal of news, it is hard to cover an important story without running into several lawyers. It is hard to be a journalist these days, I'm sorry to say, without having a lawyer at your side to worry about the possibility of libel suits, something I would hope we'd be able to get into in questions. There's a natural affinity among the lawyers and the reporters. Both groups love to talk. Both are often preoccupied with politics. And there are many in both groups with a sense of drama and a love of storytelling. My father, who had a good understanding of my character, wanted me to go into the law. I had chosen another path. And recently I've had a chance to reflect on life in journalism because of a project I'm working on, a program about journalism, which NBC will put on the air and on television in June. I find that the public knows a lot more about lawyers, for example, than it does about journalists. One of the mysteries of our craft is that we give the public information about everything in this society except journalism, who journalists are, how they work, how they think. So I want to talk tonight for a few minutes about people in my trade. And perhaps we can continue that theme in your questions when I've finished with my remarks. Journalists begin their careers in a way that's different, I think, from most career choices. I remember when I decided that I'd be a journalist, my father warning me of a lifetime of poverty. My mother wondered how I'd ever get to meet a better class of people. But I didn't care if I never made a dollar, which of course was rather more in those days than it is now. And the cops and bartenders and bookies and con men of Chicago in the 1940s, not to mention the criminal lawyers, were the most glamorous people I could think of. The difference between most journalists and most other people is that journalists, and this was certainly true of my generation, got into the business because they wanted to have fun. Fun and freedom. Someday you might write the great American novel, but in the meantime, you wanted to be a reporter, which in H.L. Mencken's immortal phrase meant living the life of kings. It didn't matter that my father was accurate when he warned me of poor pay. It's a bit different these days, but when I went into journalism, the very best you could hope for was 1 foot in the middle class at the absolute peak of your career. Nobody did it for money because newspaper salaries were so low. Nobody did it for prestige, because newspaper people were very far down the list of acceptable occupations. A few did it because their fathers had done it, but not many. Most of us went into it because it was adventurous. People with that much irresponsibility about their lives rarely go to law school. Now, today that has changed, but not as much as you might think. Let me outline two of the changes from my generation to the present crop of young journalists. One great change came about because of Woodward and Bernstein, the two young reporters who uncovered the Watergate scandals for the Washington Post. They wrote a book about that, which is made into a movie called All the President's Men, which showed these two terrific young guys working on a story of gigantic proportions. It's impressive to have Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman as your role models, and that's what they became for a few hundred thousand young people. Applications for journalism school went up after the movie came out. All of a sudden, being Woodward and Bernstein became something to do with your life. Teenagers were saying, "Golly, I can get into that business and knock off a president, for God's sake." The fact that no journalist had ever been involved before in anything like that, the fact that because of Nixon's downfall and the lesson it gave to other politicians, no reporter is ever likely to be involved in the future in anything like that, none of this mattered to that group of kids. They are older now and wiser, but it seems to me that this particular group began with a special motivation. Where most of us went into journalism to have fun, some of them went into it to uncover wrongdoing, and perhaps to have the power and notoriety of someone who successfully uncovers wrongdoing. Would I be incorrect if I speculated that people went into the law for the same reason? These young people like to talk about something called adversary journalism, a phrase which became popular during the Nixon administration or perhaps a few years earlier. I think it's a terrible phrase, and the concept which lies behind it has little to do with ordinary journalism. An adversary proceeding, as I understand it, consists of advocates on two sides of a question who choose and select the points which best make their case. Well, that's not journalism, although some journalists, most of them opinionated columnists, act as though it were. We are reporters, disciplined by editors, responsible to readers and viewers, charged with the responsibility for fairness and balance. We are not advocates unless what we do is clearly labeled opinion. The other change in the past decade or so involved young people who simply wanted to be rich and famous. That was something new in journalism. It may have started with the news that ABC was going to pay Barbara Walters $1 million a year for doing whatever it is that Barbara Walters does. It probably has been sustained by announcements of network anchor salaries, which often reach movie star levels. Mine wasn't bad, but it was never disclosed because I'm of an earlier generation, and while I like money, I don't like to talk about it. The big difference here is that practically nobody until recently got into journalism thinking of financial gain. Today, some young people do think that lightning might strike. It does not. For 99% of them, and after a few years, they learn to live with that. Most of American journalism today consists of white-collar work at blue-collar wages, despite the publicity given to a handful of superstars. And most beginning journalists today know this and try for a career in journalism because it provides freedom and fun and maybe a chance to do something useful with your life. To be fair with the people younger than I am, most have a sense that journalism can be important, which is a feeling that my young colleagues in Chicago years ago didn't have when we began. When I was getting started, we just thought it would be a life of glamorous and carefree independence. And yet, when we did get out on the street reporting, we discovered that life was both glorious and horrifying. There was fun and freedom, beauty contests and parades, but there was also death, violence, hunger, and corruption. Wow, you said, they never told me it would be like this. And you saw, day after day, things that were wrong with the society. You began to think that something more should be done to make the society better. That didn't make you a Democrat or a Republican, but it did make you think that action is better than inaction. Now, if there is a bias in the press, it seems to me, it is not a bias toward liberalism. It's a bias toward activism, and it begins not in the classrooms, but in police courts and the dingy corridors of city halls. And one day you run into the great paradox of life in journalism. You get promoted to a more important job or a more important beat, or you get sent to Washington, and you run smack into the paradox. The business you are in is more serious than you are, or you were. It is a truly serious business. It does have an effect on society, and you have to do your job as carefully and as responsibly as you can. And so there you are, trapped, faced with dread responsibility. So long, carefree independence. What you print or broadcast, edit or produce is important. But importance wasn't important when you began. Freedom was important. Fun was important. But here you are producing journalism that is meaningful, journalism that has a social impact, and that is a sobering revelation. It is called growing up, and not everyone in journalism makes it. Newsrooms all over the world have their share of middle-aged adolescents who want to go on chasing fire engines. I call them God's innocents, the eternal children of journalism. But the rest of us, heaven help us, reach the stage where we have to grow up. The trick in doing that is to shoulder the responsibility without losing the sense of fun and freedom which got you into all of this in the first place. It is easy to go astray. Some of us begin to think we are important, which is a fatal trap. Some of us are impressed by the scholarly studies of our mistakes and our alleged prejudices, which is like being an actor who reads only the bad notices. Some of us, alas, begin to think that we have to plead for special interests. Some of us are beguiled by money, ratings, or celebrity. These, in my experience, are the false paths which lead away from the fun and the freedom. They also lead away from our responsibility as mature journalists, which in Walter Lippmann's phrase is to give people a picture of the world upon which they can act. That ought to be enough for us. We should remember what John F. Kennedy was talking about when he said, "Those who create power make an indispensable contribution to the nation's greatness, but those who question power make a contribution just as indispensable, for they determine whether we use power or power uses us." And the trouble these days, ladies and gentlemen, is that a lot of Americans think the media, to use that ugly term, have themselves become too powerful. The press didn't lose the war in Vietnam, but there are those who think it did. The Washington Post didn't cause Richard Nixon to resign, but there are those who think it did. There is a feeling that the press has become too big for its britches. I don't know what we can do to change that feeling, but it strikes me that one helpful thing would be for those of us in this business to remember who we are. And that is not really like lawyers. It is like journalists. Essentially, we are observers, scorekeepers at the game, guests at the banquet. We work best as outsiders. The press has become more important in the past half century, but I don't think we ought to let that go to our heads. All of us in this business began our careers by standing outside, looking in at society. And that's where we really belong. Now, I think I've talked long enough, and I now look forward to your questions, and thank you very much.
Mr. Chancellor has assured me that he wouldn't take questions on the press in relation to the media and the law, anything. He hopes for a wide-ranging and hard-hitting discussion.
Feel free to step forward. Someone has to be first.
I can repeat that question.
Please use the microphone.
Would I like to comment on the I can't even pronounce it, Tabularia's case, the recent case in which the courts ruled that the Washington Post was guilty of libeling the former head of Mobil Oil because the Post ran a story saying that he set his son up in a business. And the court had been, the ruling is not too complicated. When it was first heard in court, the jury awarded the Washington Post $2,050,000 in damages, as I recall, and the judge, following a pattern that we've seen so often in these cases, said that the jury was wrong and overturned the verdict. It was then appealed to a three-man district appeals court in Washington, D.C., and by a judgment of 2-1, with Judge Skelly Wright dissenting, the two justices upheld the ruling of the jury, and the Washington Post is now faced with appealing a $2 million libel judgment. Now, that's a really bad one for our side, the side of journalism. We have had a pattern in journalism law in the last few years, stemming out of the Times versus Sullivan case of 1964, in which we saw juries voting against the journalistic organizations and appellate courts or judges dismissing the rulings of the jury. Now, parenthetically, this has led a number of us in journalism to begin wondering what some lawyers had been wondering before this happened, is that how valid is the jury system in certain kinds of law, and in fact, should juries be used in civil suits at all? And I know some lawyers who say that they don't think that juries ought to try or to hear, whatever juries do, you folks would know that, the civil cases, that there is a reason for them to hear criminal cases, because sometimes the human response of a jury is more humane and more just than what a judge might have to do in hearing a criminal case. But in civil cases, it has led a number of us to wish to pray that we could have a system in which judges would hear these libel suits that are against us, because juries, given the lack of credibility of the American press these days, juries almost always go against us. Now, we come to Sullivan versus the New York Times in 1964, in which a divided Supreme Court ruled that the press ought to have absolute protection to criticize public officials, absolute protection under the Constitution and the First Amendment. Well, anticipating the question, I brought along some things tonight. The fact is, and I had forgotten this, is that when the court so ruled, saying that erroneous statement is inevitable in free debate, and that it must be protected if the freedoms of expression are to have the breathing space that they need to survive. Now, that was fine. Everybody thought that was terrific in journalism, Times versus Sullivan. But three justices wrote an additional opinion in which they said that they thought the Times versus Sullivan opinion was wrong. The Times versus Sullivan opinion said, the constitutional guarantees require, we think, a federal rule that prohibits a public official from recovering damages for a defamatory falsehood relating to his official conduct unless he proves that the statement, and I'm now reading from the decision of the court, unless he proves that the statement was made with actual malice. That is, with knowledge that it was false or with reckless disregard of whether it was false or not. Okay, sounds pretty good. Turned out to be pretty bad. Interesting. Justices Goldberg, Black, and Douglas, on that same day in 1964, thought that the majority of the court had undermined the very freedom it sought to protect by putting even the slightest qualification on that freedom. And Goldberg and Black wrote, warned the court that it was opening the door to a lot of trouble. And Justice Black wrote, the requirement that malice be proved provides at best an evanescent protection for the right critically to discuss public affairs, and certainly does not measure up to the sturdy safeguard embodied in the First Amendment. And Justice Goldberg went on to say that by setting a federal rule, they were opening up journalism to an awful lot of lawsuits and other problems. And we have seen, in the wake of Sullivan, Times versus Sullivan, an awful lot of these things. Goldberg said if the government official, you see, what Goldberg was trying to do was to say that if officials are immune from libel in the performance of their duties, there should be no restraints on libel on the part of people who criticize them. That means both sides are free to say what they want to say. And Goldberg wrote, if the government official should be immune from libel actions so that his ardor to serve the public will not be dampened in fearless, vigorous, and effective administration of policies of government, then the citizen and the press should likewise be immune from libel actions for their criticism of official conduct. But what we have found, sir, in the wake of Times versus Sullivan, is that the idea of proving actual malice has got American journalism into one of the scariest situations I have ever seen. In the 35 years that I have been in this business, I've not seen it as endangered as it is. All across this country, editors are admitting to people like me that they're beginning to pull back, that they are afraid to do the hard investigative stories because they cannot afford the libel suits. And the Talavera's thing is going to scare those who haven't been scared, and they're a very small number. I was at a meeting of a great American newspaper about 2 weeks ago, the Nashville Tennessean, in the Daily News meeting at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And they had a story only mildly critical of a public official in Tennessee, a story that seemed to me and to them to be as soundly based as it possibly could, fair criticism of a public official who was doing something that the newspaper thought was not right. And in the news meeting, I heard the editor of the Nashville Tennessean say, "Get me Al Knight on the phone." And I said, "Who's Al Knight?" "Well, Al Knight's the lawyer." "And Al Knight," I said, "do you call him often?" They said, "We call him practically every day." And they read him the story, and he said, "Well, maybe you shouldn't say it quite that way. Why don't you put these words in it, soften it up a little bit?" Mr. Knight was being good counsel for the newspaper. But the readers got screwed. Now, that's terribly important, and it's happening all across the country now because of this. It gets even worse, and I will then get to your question. Excuse me for keeping you there. When the Reverend Jerry Falwell, whom I gather some of you have heard here recently, when Hustler magazine ran a really awful thing about Jerry Falwell and his mother, but they said at the bottom of that disgraceful page, it was disgraceful, they said at the bottom that this is just a parody, or they put in some kind of phrase like that, which may have been suggested by a lawyer. And so when Jerry Falwell sued for libel, he could not win his case, even though they had said those scandalous things about Falwell and his mother. So what did the jury do? The jury decided that the Reverend Falwell was made to feel bad by what was in Hustler magazine and awarded him $250,000 for feeling bad. If I know a public official in the, you know, a public figure in the United States, it's Jerry Falwell. He seeks it. He tries to be a public figure. That's the whole raison d'etre for his ministry, is to be out in public. He is a public official, a public figure. And he has now it's on appeal, but he has $250,000 because somebody made him feel bad. Now, if you were editing a newspaper or a network or a local television program, you would take all these things into consideration. And the answer to your question on the Tabularis case and the other cases that we have, even the ones we win are not good for journalism, is that all across this country, the readers and the viewers are probably today getting less information, less fair comment about the society in which they live and the officials in their government than they ought to be getting. And part of the problem is Times versus Sullivan. Part of the problem is the fact that American journalism has lost some credibility. Journalists all over the country are worried about it. But the people who are being hurt by it are the American people, the readers and the viewers of the news. And while we had, I think, the best and most robust and fair press in the world, in the United States, I think it's now in serious danger, and we're all going to be just copping out. That's the answer to your question.
Yes, following up on that question, I would ask you your opinion of the Sharon and Westmoreland cases, and also, with all due respect, you criticize so-called advocacy journalism or whatever you said, adversary journalism. But isn't it better, with all due respect, to have a paper like that, like the Village Voice, for example, which is a good example of that, than to have a paper that's just kind of terrible and a flack for the government?
Sure. Let me start, before I get to the other part of your question, with adversary journalism. I only object to adversary journalism when young journalists say they do it, when it's in the guise of straight journalism, when it's in the guise of straight reporting. I mean, obviously, in the mix of any press in any country, you not only have to have the Village Voice, you've got to have the Progressive, and you've got to have Bill Buckley, and you've got to have everybody. We deserve that. And I don't mind when Bill Buckley is an advocate for a position, or Carl Rowan, or Mike Barnicle. What bothers me is that some young people in journalism today, and I think maybe it's a little less than it was a few years ago, feel that that great river of the news itself ought to be a part of an advocacy position. Let me just tell you about American journalism and one of the things that makes it separate and better and I think quite special. And it has influenced journalism in other countries. Along about 18, I can't remember, the Telegraph, I think, was 1848 when it started. Before then, we had a lot of newspapers in America. And for some of those who were young here tonight, there wasn't any television in 1848. We had a lot of newspapers which were highly opinionated. And the Associated Press started selling news, national news, to these editors. Now, some of them were of the extreme left, and some were the extreme right, and there were very few back in those days who were of the extreme center. And the Associated Press found, for sound commercial reasons, that it had to put out a news report that was, as we might call here at Harvard, politically value-free. It just gave the facts. It became one of the dominant themes, one of the dominant voices in American journalism, that because of the AP, and later because of the UP, you got news that didn't have any political bias in it. That was an innovation in American journalism. It meant that these newspapers, in the latter half of the 19th century, and up until today, carrying the AP, began to carry more and more news that was what we now call straight news. There hadn't been much straight news up until then. The AP is not given enough credit for shaping the ethics of American journalism so that we try for facts first and opinion and advocacy second. And so, of course, opinion and advocacy have something to do with it, but let's also remember the AP, and let's also remember that it is an ethical tradition in American journalism that we try to be value-free about a lot of the stories we do. When that stream begins to be polluted by people who say, let's shape the facts, because after all, isn't this true or that true, then you're in trouble. On Sharon and Westmoreland, I thought that Westmoreland had kind of a case myself. I was sort of with Westy on that one. When we saw the editing come out that CBS had done, I was embarrassed for my own business. On Sharon, I am uncomfortable, and I'm not a legal specialist, about somebody coming here, filing suit in our own courts in order to help his political reputation in another country. And I think that's clearly what Sharon did. Everybody in Israel believes that. And I don't think he had much of a case. At the same time, Time magazine was guilty, I think, of some sloppy reporting and some sloppy checking. And that's what got Time magazine in trouble. And for all of the faith that I have in Time magazine, it's a pretty good outfit. I think that they asked for the trouble they got into, and they had a very adept politician who jumped in fast and gave them a hell of a scare. And so those trials, both of them, and I have written and said this on the air, both of those trials did not make journalism in America look much better. Okay? Thank you.
Mr. Chancellor, many of us grew up watching your political commentaries through the convention season, general elections, Senate races, House races. With the Reagan phenomena of being the great communicator, it seems that the emphasis on the party has taken a second place role to the emphasis on the media reporting political events in this country and shaping the ways and the ethos in which people vote and view the political institutions we have today. I just wondered what you saw as the role of the political party in the future, and perhaps comment on your career in terms of observing campaigns and politicians in general.
Well, the role of can you all hear the question? The role of the parties, I think, is in terrible shape in the United States. And my career in journalism is long enough so that I can remember when the parties were quite important, when the national chairman of the Republican or the Democratic parties was a man to reckon with, and long stories would be written when he had things to say. A number of things have happened to destroy the parties. The easy technology of the media to cover somebody, the metastasization of the primaries, presidential primaries all over the country has had a lot to do with breaking down the party. And I decry this. I think it's a terrible thing that the parties have been pushed aside. because the parties, with the professional people who were running the parties, saw to it that the American voters, they moved politics gently toward the center. There were differences between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, but they didn't give you kooks who ran for president. They didn't give you crazies who ran for president. They gave you people who were pretty acceptable to large numbers of American voters, either side. I think that's good. I think a gentle nudge toward the center is, it will tell you something about my politics when I say I think I'm comfortable with that. The fact is that in America today, you can run for president with an organization about the size of a baseball team. Let's add it up. You've got the candidate, you've got a fundraiser, you've got a media buyer, you've got a pollster, you've got a press secretary, you have a couple of speech writers, and maybe one or two people to advise you to do the research on issues. Nine people. Jimmy Carter did it with fewer than that. Won the nomination and the presidency. Didn't have anything to do with the Democratic Party. George Bush went a very long way. Almost got the nomination. Beat Ronald Reagan in Iowa. With a tiny organization. He didn't have nine. He had 4.5. And it scares me when people can run for the highest office in the land without the support of or the endorsement of one of our great political parties. And yet, we've seen that in the last two presidents of the United States. The primary system and the technology of politics today allow unemployed people to run for the presidency and win it. Reagan was unemployed. Carter was unemployed. It makes it extremely difficult for somebody like Howard Baker, who is a moderate centrist Republican who did a fine job as majority leader of the United States Senate, to try for it. So what did Howard Baker do? He quit. He's now back in Tennessee putting together a national organization. Will that have a lot to do with the Republican Party? I am not so sure. So the parties, as the great moderating influences in American life, are being diminished in their power, and we're leaving the highest office in the land vulnerable to people. I mean, I like Jesse Jackson. I think Jesse Jackson is an interesting man, one of the most interesting politicians I ever saw in my life. But I'm not absolutely certain that Jesse Jackson could have got as far as he did if we didn't have the primary system and if we didn't have the weakened parties. I think they would have found a way to embrace Jesse Jackson and bring him in. This is not critical of him. He'd say this if he were here. He said it to me. The system of primaries makes it possible to come in as an outsider and really make a run for the top job. And I think we ought to do away with the primaries. If you want to get back to this, I'll tell you my alternate plan, but I won't do it now. I think we ought to get rid of the primaries and go back to a system where the parties, which represent millions and millions of mainstream Americans, have more to say about the people we elect. One final point. All democracies use elections to choose their leaders. The United States is the only democracy to use elections to choose the candidate. And I think that's wrong. Let's see. Where were you? Were you over here? You're next.
My question relates something to what was just said. It's about political conventions, party conventions. And it seems that in this time, each election, the convention's becoming less and less newsworthy, in the sense that in the last campaign, we knew exactly who was going to be running for both parties for both positions a couple weeks before the convention started. My question is there a need now for a change in convention coverage, or is there a need for covering a convention at all when it's mainly a chance for a party to put propaganda on the television for people to see?
I don't think it's a change in the coverage. We're stuck with these dinosaurs. And for reasons that sometimes are not very attractive, frankly. I mean, the networks are all in competition to show how good they are. And what kind of technical competence and journalistic skill and wonderful anchor people they have and all that. I've gone through that. So that they cover these things in force even when there's no story. and you are absolutely accurate that there hasn't been much of a story at the last few conventions. In 1976, when the Democrats nominated Jimmy Carter as their presidential candidate in New York City, they could have held the convention in the post office across the street. It would have been very easy for all the delegates who were pledged beforehand. Remember that? They were all pledged. They couldn't change their vote when they got in the hall. Although many of them would rather have voted for Teddy Kennedy by the time they got there, under law they couldn't change their vote. So they could have sent in registered letters. We could have had the convention in 12 hours in the post office opening the mail. That's not a convention. That's a mockery of a convention. A convention is supposed to be representative groups of Americans who feel strongly about a political party getting together, having debates, having a wonderful fight, and agreeing on somebody and cheering it. Now, the Democrats have gone back a little bit. They don't have the pledged delegates they used to have. But the primaries lock up the delegates anyway. That's one of the terrible things about the primary system. So that what I would love to have, and I guess I am going to say this, which I was going to wait for later, is what I'd like to have, and I'm attacked by everybody for this because it's utopian and it's elitist. I would like to have a series of 50 state party conventions. In every state and territory, I would like the Republicans to have a convention and the Democrats to have a convention. And I would like to have people like Howard Baker and Jack Kemp and Joe Biden and Teddy Kennedy, if they want to run for president, go and address those conventions or send surrogates to those conventions. That would make it a little more cerebral than the kind of advertising, the crazed campaigning we see in the primaries. It would mean they would have to offer positions to the whole country. It would mean that the first primary wouldn't be in a place like Iowa or New Hampshire, which are totally unrepresentative of the American society. It would mean that you'd have to clean up your act if you wanted to run for president, present real ideas to people, and then, here's the elitist part, I would like to have those conventions pick the very best people within their state and within their party. Nobel Prize winners, university presidents, really classy people. And I would like to have them sent, despite what some of you may think, really classy people, and have them sent to a convention, a national convention, which would sit in sovereign assembly, not be bound, and hear the candidates again, and make the best decision. That would be a story to cover. That would be marvelous. And the whole country would be watching, instead of the very dismal kind of thing that we have now. I hope that's responsive to your question.
Yeah, I'm curious whether you think Reagan's exclusion of the press from Grenada marks a dangerous trend towards censorship of coverage of sensitive topics.
Well, the exclusion of the press from Grenada is something about which one could write a book. I mean, there are so many surprises in it. Your recent speaker, Secretary Weinberger, you may recall when the American troops went into Grenada, came out and said with his hand over his heart, "We left that to the local commanders. We would never here in the Pentagon dream of interfering with the local commanders. It's their responsibility. Nothing to do with me," said Cap Weinberger. Lies. He told the New York Times 2 weeks later that he had made the decision. What the American people saw on television and read in their newspapers was that he hadn't had anything to do with it. And if you hadn't read the Times, you wouldn't learn that. And the Pentagon confirmed that what he said was right. He kept them out. Is this a pattern? I think the Reagan administration and some parts of the American population would like to have the press kept out of all of those things. But what I found was very interesting was that about 5 days after the American press was excluded from Grenada, week after, I suppose, ABC and the Washington Post ran a poll that showed that a majority of the Americans across the country they polled thought that the press ought to have been there. And about 2 weeks later, Lou Harris did a national poll, and he found that by then that 63%, which is okay with me, 63% thought that the American press should have been with the first wave when they went into Grenada. So I think that we have considerable support for the idea that when the government goes into military operations, the American press ought to be there. Is this going to deter them from trying to keep us out again? I don't think so. I think this administration is uncomfortable with the idea of the press. There were many things in Grenada that were hopelessly screwed up by the American military. This was an island that was under presidential scrutiny for a couple of years. Mr. Reagan had been making speeches about it, and yet some of the troops went in with tourist maps which were inaccurate. They didn't know where all the American students were when they landed. It is what is called, Grenada is what is called porous in the intelligence community. It's an English-speaking island with lots of tourists. You could have known.
Feel about the press sometimes, and yet we've talked about Watergate, which was a great scoop for the press. We've talked about presenting value-free news, and in a large part, technology and the press today are incredibly important to people. Why is it that, why do you feel that Americans have sort of a schizophrenic view of the press, and in one way they value it, they want it to be very free, and on the other hand, they distrust it, and what do you think, or how do you think the press has contributed to that?
Well, I think a lot of things have happened, but they all are small and individual examples, and I think they add up to a problem of credibility for the American press. Let me just give you a couple of examples. Do you, in this room, do we watch presidential press conferences when they're on television? You watch those, right? Okay. You see reporters asking the president rude questions? You're a pretty smart bunch of people. You probably don't think they're rude questions. Let's take ourselves off to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and ask the people in Tuscaloosa, or let's take a little town outside of Denver somewhere, and they're sitting there with their Coors beer, and they're watching the television, and there are all these people from the press contradicting the President of the United States. How dare they? I mean, he's the president. He's our holiest figure. Now, this happens, I mean, in some ways, the press is lucky because Reagan doesn't have too many press conferences. But it happened with Kennedy, it happened with Carter, it happened with all of them. Now, the technology has come along, so the presidents like to run the risky course of having a live presidential press conference on television. I'll get in there and mix it up with those reporters, right? Make me look good. And so the reporters do what the reporters were doing when Roosevelt was president, when Hoover was president, when Truman and Eisenhower were presidents. They are asking tough questions of the president. That is their job. But until television came along, and until Jack Kennedy said, let's have live press conferences, nobody ever saw those. You were not allowed to quote the president directly, as some of you will recall. The president is known to believe, the president said, but no direct quote. Eisenhower allowed cameras to record his press conferences, but they filmed them, and we could not put them on television until they were cleared by the White House in case the president made a mistake. So then, and the reporters were more courteous in those days, I think, than they are now. But the fact is that reporters asking the hard questions, which ought to be asked of a president, are seen by a lot of Americans to be rude, to be against him, to be trying to tear him down, trying to make him look bad. It's the nature of questions. Now, you have that repeated all across the country when mayors have press conferences that are on live television, or congressmen and all of that. I'm going into some detail on this because that's one of the reasons I think it's so important that they think that we are too big for our britches, that we're a bunch of arrogant leftists. I dealt a little bit in my prepared remarks. Sure, there's a bias in the press. There is a bias toward let's fix up the problems. If people are deprived of their rights because of race, let's do something about it. I said that. If there are so many people who are hungry or kids being born out of wedlock, let's do something about it. We are, by nature, activists in the press. We are not just passive scribes. We wouldn't be in this business if we didn't get caught up in some of those things that we get paid to look at. Sure, we start because we think it's fun and marvelous and glamorous, but we find out that life is pretty cruel, and then you do get involved in it. There was a a poll taken a few years ago of Washington correspondents that showed that Washington correspondents supported the idea of a woman's right to have an abortion, that were for gun control, that were for ERA, and that were for a number of other social questions that put them out of sync with the American population. They took more liberal positions than the American population did by sizable numbers. And that was used in a lot of articles and speeches saying, you see, we told you all along. Here's a poll of the press that proves it. These people are all crazed leftists. Well, I think that probably some of us are out of sync with the American people. And I'll tell you what, miss, I celebrate that. I would rather have a press that does more thinking about the country, that arrives at positions that maybe the country doesn't have in their personal lives, that feels strongly about some of these things. I'd rather have that than a lot of clones of what the Gallup poll tells us American people feel. I think it would be terrible to have the clones. I think you have to have, if journalism is intellectual to the tiny degree that it may be, then I think we're probably going to turn out the way that poll showed we turned out, that we are for a change, that we are for things, that we do feel that there are a lot of things wrong in the American society that ought to be fixed. But that's part of the lack of credibility, because our opponents have made people think that we are, because we went to the wrong schools, some even went to Harvard, that we went to the wrong schools, that we were subverted by these chronic leftist professors. And I've had this argument face to face with an awful lot of conservatives who say, you know, you're a nice fella. I like you. I mean, I'd have you to my house. But you're crazy. You're one of those liberals. And it's very difficult to deal with that. Now, that's part of the credibility problem. So there are a number of other things. Television, I think, is very bad. Television is guilty, they say, of great intrusions of privacy. I think there's some truth to that. If Abraham Lincoln, it's sort of off the point, but if Abraham Lincoln were president today and he made the Gettysburg Address, the NBC Nightly News would boil it down to 32 seconds. It only ran about 2.5 minutes, but they'd boil it down. But if Lincoln cried when he made the Gettysburg Address, every tear would be on television. Now, I think people resent that. I think it's what I call the Chinese water torture of television news. People don't get mad the first time, but after 10 years of it, they begin to get kind of angry about it. When was the last time you ever heard anybody finish a sentence on the CBS Evening News? Right? Well, I think that erodes. You know, I think it so that we've got people like Falwell against us. We've got Ronald Reagan against us, no matter what he says, he is. We are guilty of a lot of things ourselves. The technology is exposing our underwear, which is not terribly clean. And I think credibility is going down. Now, how would we get around that? I think by telling people more about what we do and who we are. Because I think it's an honorable profession. I think that the American press, and I've been a foreign correspondent for much of my life, the American press is something of which we ought to be just terribly proud. It's diverse, it's generally honest, it's terrific. There is a storehouse of information available to any American citizen who wants to go and look at it every day. Honest information. But I don't think we've told our own story, and that makes me uncomfortable because I don't like to flack for my own profession, but that's what I'm doing here tonight, and that's a long, windy answer to your question.
I guess this is, in some senses, a follow-up to that question and some of the things you've touched on before. You talked about a lot of the changes recently in the past decade or so in journalism, proliferation of a lot more journalists, adversarial journalism, journalism getting too big for its britches. And I'm wondering if you think, or how do you think, those changes have deterred, or have they deterred, potential, very promising people from entering the field, and if that's made a qualitative difference?
I don't have any figures I can give you, but in talking to the way into journalism used to be that you went and simply got a job in it. Now the way into journalism quite often is to go to journalism school. And in talking to the deans of journalism school that I know, I mean, I think they still have an awful lot of people in those schools who want to go into journalism. I don't think that the criticism that those of us of my generation feel is out in the country about it, the loss of credibility in American journalism, is felt by young people. I think young people still see it, as I saw it, as a way of getting into a business where you got paid for writing. I mean, on the first day I got a paycheck, and I realized that it was because I had written things that they were paying me. I was a professional writer. I mean, that was the most glorious day of my life. And I think a lot of young people today have that same feeling about it, which is why I said in my remarks that, sure, some get into it because they want to be Dan Rather or Diane Sawyer, and some get into it because they've got a chip on their shoulder, which didn't used to exist as much, I think, as it does today. And some get into it because they want to be Woodward or Bernstein. That, I think, is a little different now. But most want to get into it because, to be honest, no other vocational call is clear. I mean, they haven't been really sucked in by the study of the law or architecture or medicine. And they say, what am I going to do with my life? An awful lot of people who don't know what they want to do with their lives who go into journalism. True.
If I may interrupt, we have time for about two or three very short questions.
So that, just in final answer, I don't think that the hostility that you find, which you very often find against the press among older Americans, is affecting their children. An awful lot of it is that criticism comes from people who are over 50. And then there's a middle group that may have some doubts, but then as you get down the scale, I've seen the polls, as you get down the scale, it is there's not much criticism among the young.
How do you feel about allowing cameras in the courtroom, specifically the trial courts? Do you feel they're necessary for a broadcast journalist to cover the courts effectively, or are they just going to make it harder to have fair trials for the parties involved?
Well, I presume that Professor Tribe is known to some of you here. Uh-huh. He and I have discussed this at length. I think Larry Tribe has persuaded me that maybe cameras aren't so bad in the courtroom. I really have been against it. Instinctively, I am against it. In my education taught me that open courtrooms were designed to protect the defendants against star chamber proceedings. That the idea in England was that if the state hauled you before the bar of justice, that some of your friends ought to be allowed in so the state couldn't manhandle you. Now, that, it seemed to me, didn't mean that the public ought to be allowed in a general way. And I thought that the old idea that you could get a group of your friends to sit in the courtroom, and if you were given injustice, they could complain, was the way it ought to work. I did not think that trials ought to be, and I do not think that trials ought to be, public property. I mean, I read all the stories about Klaus von Bülow, but I don't know that I would want to watch that on television. I'm not sure what it's going to do to judges. I presume some of you understand that judges are capable of grandstanding, the way the lawyers are, and the defendants are. I'm not sure what the cameras would do, for example, to the United States Senate. I'm not sure that it's going to make the Senate any more responsible a body, and that phrase in itself sends some people into hysterics, but that it's going to make the Senate any better, or it's going to make the courts any better. I think if you closed the courts, it would be a constitutional disaster for Americans. But I don't know that opening them up all the way so that everybody can see is going to lead to anything other than a kind of a lot of Well, shall we watch the von Bülow case or shall we watch General Hospital today? And that troubles me. You know, I think of some poor, hapless guy who gets, or woman, who gets nabbed by the authorities, perhaps wrongly, and goes to trial, and there, by God, is a television camera, and you've got 2 million people watching. It makes me very uncomfortable. Now, Tribe has some terrific arguments about this, that in which he says he doesn't think the excesses will take place, and he thinks that it's not against the idea of English common law. And I must say, when I talked to him about it, I found him very persuasive, but I've kind of given you my side of the argument. I don't think we ought to put... I think there are too many television cameras in the world as it is right now.
Mr. Chancellor, I have a question about the activism of the press as it relates to a specific issue. If a black or a woman runs for mayor or for political office, it's always the first black candidate or the first woman candidate. I mean, the label she or the label black or the person right. gay is always placed on that person. If a white male runs, it's always the person, the candidate running for office or the mayor of that city. Now, I'm wondering if the activism of the press is going to turn itself to more neutral labels so that these types of divisions between race and sex, et cetera, that develop in our society and in part stem from language won't be reinforced. I wonder if you can address that. It's something
that's a good, important, and sophisticated question. The answer that I can give you is probably not going to help much. The journalism has, in its mindless idiocy, it loves firsts. I mean, the UP used to write leads saying, "This never happened before in Providence, Rhode Island, on a Thursday." I mean, they just go crazy. We all do. First black. It isn't black that's important. It's first. First woman. First is more important than woman. Journalism loves firsts, lasts, peaks, valleys. So I don't think you're going to get much alteration in that until the society changes. Now, let's take women, for example. Jerry Ferraro, vice presidential candidate. Is journalism going to say when, I don't know who, Bella Abzug becomes a vice presidential candidate, are they going to say second? No, that's boring. First is interesting. Second is okay. So that I think the passage of entry into the language of these formulations that you're talking about is that, yes, you get stung on firsts, but not on seconds or thirds or fourths. Nobody's ever going to run that. Probably somebody will write in 1988 that Ms. Collins, the governor of Kentucky, is the fifth woman to put her name into the presidential primary ring. Well, that's another kind of journalism, because five women is important. You want to know that there are five. But the idea of first, I'm afraid, is with us. And it has nothing to do with racism or sexism or anything. It has to do with firstism, which is a passion of journalism. Because journalism is, you know, nobody in journalism has a definition of what news is. You can talk to 10 journalists, you get 10 different definitions of what's news. Mine, which is only mine, is that it is a chronicle of conflict and change. The society needs to know about conflicts within it and change that may affect it. And that leads us into a chronicle of bad news, usually, not such good news. But that's what I think it is. And first is a very important word when you're talking about change. So that I think we're not going to get rid of that until the society changes. We no longer say the first Italian. We no longer say the first this, that, and the other thing. I think the blacks are still vulnerable to it in many political offices, and I think women are more vulnerable than blacks. So I think you're going to have it for a few more years, and then after that, you won't hear it anymore.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you what alternative you propose to the Sullivan standard for libel, and whether... the question, professional questioners, whether it's whether you don't think that there should be some mechanism to question those professional questioners.
You mean, let me just make sure I understand you. Are you asking me if I think that there should be some way that a citizen who feels libeled by or damaged by a news organization can go to court in some way? Is that
or a public official?
It breaks down into a couple of different things. One is that, as they said in Sullivan, which I thought was the sound language in that decision, that it is the responsibility of citizens to criticize, as it is the responsibility of public officials to govern, to do their jobs. And so that therefore the court upheld the rule that public officials, say members of the Congress, can say anything they want to and be free of libel in the course of their official duties. The change that seems to have come about is that they are insulated from being sued for libel, and we are not. And so therefore, I think that there ought to be a way found so that you can get damages, but I'm not sure that public officials should be able to get those damages. I think the court, and perhaps even the framers of the Constitution, and I'm not an expert on that, felt that if you got the responsibilities and the benefits of holding public office, maybe you shouldn't be able to bring libel suits that way. I think that was the intent in Sullivan. Now, for private citizens, and Mr. Talaveras is a private citizen, for private citizens, I think there should be a way of bringing news organizations to account. And so I'm very murky about how we go about that, because I don't think we should hide under an absolutist interpretation of the First Amendment. I mean, if I write that if with reckless disregard that you have been cheating on your exam, and you can prove that I just made that up, I ought to pay a price for it. I really should, if I have truly damaged you. And that takes us back, I think, maybe before Sullivan. What would I like the court to do? We'll just engage in fantasy here for a minute. I would like the court to march in there tomorrow morning and say, well, we've talked it all over, ladies and gentlemen, and Sullivan is wrong. Now we're going to issue this, and we're going to take that particular language about absolute malice out of it, and we're going to reissue this. That'll never happen. It'll have to come up through the courts. It may take a very long time, and in the meantime, your freedoms are going to be, and my freedoms too, are going to be more and more restricted. I'm sorry I haven't given you a good answer to that, but those are just some of my thoughts.
Thank you.
Miss?
Yes, at the end of the coverage they did on South Africa, ABC News, Ted Koppel was commenting on the positive impact he thought that type of coverage had, though I'm kind of skeptical about it. I was wondering what you thought about the coverage itself and also the type of impact you thought it had on South Africa and on our position and our investment there.
Well, first I thought Koppel did a very good job. We're talking about Nightline when Ted Koppel went to South Africa and managed, and the first night I think he got Botha and Bishop Tutu on the same program, although not from the same studio. I thought it was useful journalism. I thought it was, I think it's airing the problem of South Africa in a pretty useful way. If we believe, as I do, that South Africa is going to have to change its ways, and that that's going to be a very important story that will take place sometime before the end of this century, which is only 15 years away, then I think the more light we can shine on it, the better off everybody is going to be, and more people are going to understand it. Tom Brokaw of our staff went down there and did a number of pieces. It's getting kind of popular now for journalism to focus on South Africa. And I think that that's probably to the good, because we have one set of ideas about South Africa, and the South Africans have another. And I think they do pay attention when a lot of big media in the United States are looking at their problems and describing them. And I saw, I guess, two of the Koppel programs, and I thought they were distinguished journalism. So I'd be for more coverage of South Africa, not less. I would like to see more news bureaus open up there, and not only from us, but from the Europeans as well. Last question?
Do you think the media can retain its independence if the raiders like Jesse Helms takes over some of the newspapers or television? What are the chances?
Can we retain our independence if Jesse Helms takes over? Can I have a couple of minutes to deal with that? You know why Jesse Helms is in the U.S. Senate, madam?
He had $24 million.
No? Well, there's that. I once worked for a program at the National Broadcasting Company called the Huntley-Brinkley Report. It was the predecessor to my anchoring. The Huntley-Brinkley Report so outraged the owner of our affiliated station in Raleigh, North Carolina, that what they did was they took and hired a man to criticize Huntley-Brinkley every night right after it went off the air. It would be, good night, Chet, good night, David, and then this guy would come on and say, that was terrible what they just said. Jesse Helms. That's who it was. True story. We made him what he is today.
Now,
I want to answer your question carefully. So now here we have Senator Helms. Who would ever have thought? And he wants to take over CBS. And so do a lot of other people. And he wants to turn it into a network that he would be happy with. A network that would give conservative news. Well, some facts. There have been a number of scholarly studies that show, or studies by scholars, that probably is more accurate, that show that CBS has been easier on Ronald Reagan than the other two networks. And that's going in. CBS is not guilty of a liberal bias. The problem that you would have if you took over CBS is that if you walked into the newsroom and said, good morning, it's the first day of the new administration and now we're all going to be good conservatives, half of them would quit. There would be some quislings and some toadies who would stay. The ratings would go right down and they would lose their money. There have been a number of attempts in the United States to put out good news publications or conservative publications. Most of them, some have prospered. The National Review is doing reasonably well. It only loses, I suppose, $300,000 or $400,000 a year. It is not a mainstream publication. There was an outfit called Good News that published a newspaper called Good News, which went out of business in 6 months. You cannot take a great mainstream news organization like CBS and change its compass orientation. It won't work. Those people will not work for you. They have pride. They have ethics. They won't do it. Kay Graham, who owns the Washington Post, has said on many occasions the one misconception that is most widespread about her is that she can go into the Washington Post newsroom and tell them what to put in the paper. She can't. There's no way. Ben Bradley would quit. They'd all quit. So that they're really, this is fantasy, the idea that Jesse Helms and a group of his conservative buddies can get in there and take over CBS News and continue it as CBS News. And finally, and I know I'm running on about this, the one thing that, bad as some of these network news operations are, and I think some of them are shallow, and they have their good nights and their bad nights are just awful, they do represent a kind of a marketplace judgment by the American people. They are more or less, and you can criticize them, and if you want to talk after, I'll do that. You can criticize them for a lot of their omissions, not so many of their commissions. But the fact is that that's mainstream American journalism, and it isn't really terribly biased, and I think it's far too kind to the president, currently. But when I go to Paris and I want to find out what's going on in France, I have to buy about 8 newspapers. I have to take those 8 newspapers and go through them because I know that Figaro is conservative. And I know what's in that. And I know L'Aurore is conservative. I know what's in that. And I have to get Le Monde and put it over there kind of on the left. I have to do a lot of work to find out what's going in France. Because each journalistic institution represents part of the political spectrum. Now, in the United States, you don't have to do that. I think we are infinitely better served by our press, despite its bad faults. And what Jesse Helms really wants to do is to Europeanize the American press. He, Spiro Agnew before him, Spiro Agnew once said, wouldn't it be nice if we had a conservative network, a middle-of-the-road network, and a left-wing network? Then we'd all know where we stood, right? Impossible to do in American journalism, given the dynamics and the ethics of this profession. So that, yes, I get all upset when I hear the ravings of Senator Helms. And because I know it won't work ethically in terms of journalism, financially in terms of CBS stock, and I just think it's all nonsense. It's a menacing kind of nonsense, and it's something we ought to worry about. I don't think anybody could ever do it, but it's got people at CBS scared to death. And I think if they were coming after NBC, which is an equal kind of target, I think we'd be scared to death too about that. So it's not very comfortable to have them doing these things, but what they're trying to do is, I think, impossible to accomplish. And on that thoroughly confusing note, I thank you all for having me.
I'd like to thank Mr. Chancellor for coming by. Thank you all for visiting.